using science to debunk myths. From the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sky Dragon Slaying, where we bring you the truth on science and current affairs the mainstream would rather you didn't know. I'm John O'Sullivan, CEO of Principia Scientific International. Joining me as usual is Texas engineer extraordinaire Joe Elson. And from Canada, we have space scientist Joe Posmer. Our special guest today is a fellow slayer, Charles Anderson, PhD. Dr. Anderson is an applied scientist. He's a materials physicist with a 38-year career in the use of radiation and analyzing materials. He runs a highly successful laboratory business in the United States, helping clients to solve complex materials problems quickly and efficiently. Not only that, but more importantly for us in our discussion today, Dr. Anderson is he's got great expertise in radiation spectroscopy, which qualifies him very, very well to talk about the claims of government climate scientists about radiation greenhouse gas theory. Now, Dr. Anderson, he's very well known to us because he's actually co-author of the book that we wrote in 2010 called Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. And it's still accepted as the world's first and only comprehensive debunk of the junk science that claims carbon dioxide is the climate's control knob. Hi, Charles. How are you today?
I'm very good. How are you?
Very well. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's a world of technology. We worked together all those years ago, but we've never actually spoken, have we? This is the very first time we've actually talked.
No, we've always exchanged emails or essays, as it were, on climate change and nothing much else.
No, it's incredible, really, isn't it, that all those years have passed. It's over a decade now, and that the book itself, as Joe Olson said several times, it took a while to get any traction because obviously people didn't want to hear the idea that the greenhouse gas theory was in dispute. We know the debate was rigged. We know that there were those who weren't going to question the role of carbon dioxide. And you're one of the reasons we really wanted you as a co-author is because of your unique background. You're an applied scientist. And we always argue that applied scientists, they have more of a handle on the real world than academics who work in universities. And they don't test their applications as rigorously as we would like. So what actually got you into the debate? What triggered your interest?
Well, initially, it was probably about 2007, and I was hearing that man was causing catastrophic problems for the Earth's climate in the future, namely warming, because of the emissions of CO2 gases from using fossil fuels, as they called them, or as I prefer to call them, carbon-based fuels. And I just thought, well, that's very interesting if it's possible, but it seems like it stretches the imagination a bit. So I better look into that. And as I started to look into it, I found that, well, first of all, it was rather difficult to find a coherent theory that they were actually providing. They were talking sort of hand-waving ways about what their ideas were, but to find the details of it was very hard to do. And that sort of sent off some alarm bells for me, that thinking that, well, there's something kind of fishy here that needs more looking into, because some of these things ought to be very straightforward. For instance, one of the things that I found that it was not easy to find information on was, well, how far does a infrared photon emitted from the Earth's surface travel before it's first absorbed by a so-called greenhouse gas in the atmosphere? And it turns out that's a variable distance for different frequencies, but still there should be sort of an average for the various molecules how far the radiation from the Earth would travel before a particular molecule, say water vapor or CO2, would absorb one of these photons. So that number just wasn't being talked about. And that seemed to me that, well, that's a key thing. It's an extremely important number, and yet there's no discussion about it. So there's something wrong there. Another thing that was hard to find was that, well, once a molecule has absorbed a photon from the Earth, now it's an excited state, and eventually it's going to re-emit a photon, or it might. How long does that take? Shouldn't that be something that they're openly discussing and it's easy to find. And it turned out, well, no, that wasn't easy information to find. So all the things that they should have needed to do the actual type of calculations that would back up their hypothesis that CO2 was causing warming of the atmosphere and the Earth's surface, these things were just not being talked about in an open way. And so I started to look into it. And the more I looked into it, the more I thought that, gee, they just there were a lot of things that they had wrong. So, for instance, say they put together these Earth energy budgets. And the Earth energy budgets had numbers in them that seemed to me to violate conservation of energy. So that was one of the things that really bothered me. If you have a influx of photons from, which is, you know, various radiation in the form of photons from the sun incident upon the Earth's atmosphere, and 30% of that roughly is reflected. So only about 70% of it interacts with the Earth's atmosphere or the Earth's surface. And yet, despite that, they claim that the Earth's surface was emitting, oh, commonly a number would be 117% of the total of the sun's radiant energy upon the top of the Earth's atmosphere. So that, you know, discarding the 30% that was reflected and never interacted really with the Earth's atmosphere or the surface, they were still claiming that instead of the Earth having, say, a maximum of 70% emission, no, it had 117% emission. So where did all that extra energy come from? That really has always bothered me. And then, of course, they had this image of an amount of energy being coming from the atmosphere and being incident upon the Earth's surface, so-called back radiation, that was commonly 100% of the amount of radiation that was incident on the Earth's atmosphere. I think that was the actual number, or close to it. So there were many things here that were just very disturbing.
Just to jump in, I mean, I just want to make it clear to listeners that you're, as an applied scientist, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but you serve as an expert witness in court, in litigation, in court cases. I notice you're on jurispro.com as an expert witness there. You know, when you give your analysis of something, you back it up with numbers and things are verified. And it's a scientific method, isn't it? You verify it, and other people independently from you can verify your numbers. They can go into a lab, they can check it, they can replicate your claims. And correct me again if I'm wrong, you found no way to corroborate these claims, these numbers that are put out, and you're saying, you know, for example, the difference between 70% to 117%, that's a huge difference. And we're often told in debate that it's just a rounding error. It's certain fudge factors that we shouldn't really pay attention to. And it's something that we've got thoroughly sick of, because we're palmed off with this idea. Don't worry, it's all in the global computer models. The computer models, they account for all that. You know, don't you worry yourself with that. But that is not how science is done, is it? This is a key fundamental issue when you're having a discussion among scientists. Scientists should be able to show, according to the scientific method, they're working out, you know, show the math is important. The numbers are essential to validating the merits of a claim. And this is something, Joe Olson, you would like to talk about yourself, because you've had this conversation many times with people. As an engineer, you know yourself, numbers are important, aren't they?
What we need to distinguish here is that electromagnetic radiation is emitted by everybody with a temperature above 0 degrees Kelvin. So you can emit electromagnetic energy as a human being at 98.6 in the 10 micron range. So, but you can't take your emitted energy and reflect it back at yourself and raise your body's temperature. So, you know, a mirror is a hell of a lot better, quote, reflector of energy than a 3-atom, or in the case of methane, 4-atom gas molecule. So what is actually happening in the atmosphere is you have a full spectrum incoming radiation What is absorbed is then really just a temporary resonance in certain frequency ranges by the various gases that are in the atmosphere, and it's followed in a billionth of a second by an emission of a longer wavelength, lower energy. And this is called Stokes shift, named after Charles Stokes, who was also one of the principals in founding the Stokes-Napier fluid dynamics equation. So, but the whole thing is pretty much cooked science. The fact that they claim that the radiation temperature of the Earth is 88 degrees Kelvin, which for people that don't speak in K's, we can call that 58.73 degrees Fahrenheit or 14.85 degrees centigrade, and that the black body radiation is calculated as being 255 degrees Kelvin or about 0.67 degrees. And so there's a 33 degree Kelvin temperature difference that they just magically make up as being created in the atmosphere by a gas, and no gas in the atmosphere can capture, store, redirect, or amplify radiant energy. All that happens is it goes from a level of higher energy to a level of lower. And so the Earth gives energy off into the atmosphere. The atmosphere gives energy off into outer space. And the other weird thing is that they take the incoming total insulation at the top of the atmosphere as 1,360 watts per square meter. And then in order to convert a sphere's surface to a flat plane round surface, they divide that by four and they say, oh, the Earth gets 340 watts per square meter 24 hours a day. And it's like, well, gee, it's really not flat, like Postma would say, and it's not daytime all the time. So bottom line is they've just cooked up a whole bunch of numbers that can fool people that do not have any science or mathematic education and make them believe these fairy tales. And, you know, if it's simple enough that a high school dropout like Greta Thunberg can explain it, then it's too simple for reality.
Yeah, and our colleague, our good friend and colleague and co-author of the book, Dr. Tim Bull, qualified as a climatologist, he made the point very clearly that you're saying cooking the numbers. Well, he didn't pull his punches, did he, with calling out Dr. Michael Mann. We all know Dr. Michael Mann. He was a leading light in the UN IPCC panel of scientists from academia, all paid very well to tout the narrative. And Michael Mann, known for his hockey stick graph, and poor old Tim Bull called him out on the numbers, didn't he? Called him out on the numbers and said, Mann, who worked at the time at Penn State, he said, Michael Mann shouldn't be in Penn State. He should be in the state pen. And lo and behold, he sued him, multi-million-dollar lawsuit. So, you know, that was, in a way, what really kicked off interest in our book. The fact that the world-leading climate scientist at the time, Michael Mann, would sue our co-author, Dr. Tim Bull, for multi-million-dollar lawsuit for libel, attracted a lot of attention, because I think we hit the nail on the head, didn't we, when we said it's gerrymandering the numbers. And Charles, you know, you're a specialist in spectroscopy. Tim Bull was a specialist in climatology, and we all tend to agree that you do need a lot of specialties, don't you? It's such a complex. There's nothing more complex than trying to explain the Earth's climate, and we argue that nobody even really knows how the climate really operates. We know the fundamentals. We know that the sun initially is the energy source. And we know that the oceans, by the water cycle, that, if anything, is the real moderator of temperatures, the water cycle. And to then try and reconfigure the whole narrative as a, you know, a radiative problem from CO2, that CO2 is a climate control knob, we just found that was just taking everything too far, taking liberties with the science to the point of criminality, I would argue. And I know some of you agree with that. Joe Postma, would you share that viewpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, climate science, it totally throws out the fundamentals of how the climate works. And in fact, as I've shown in my books and proven with it, with I experimented on the climate science and even on the physics community. Just by trying to publish a paper, which states very simply that the sun heats the Earth, just stating it in a scientific way, and they would reject it. And climate science, we saw the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. I have this in my videos and in my book, what happened with the peer review process with them. They literally took out the part of my paper where I say that the sun heats the earth, and then they say in response, you have no evidence of that. We reject your paper for publication because you're just saying something with no evidence. So they completely throw out the basic fundamentals of how the climate works. As Joelson was pointing out, you know, and I like to write about in my book all the time and talk about often in my videos, it basically reduces to flat earth theory. They take this hot sunshine, you know, you can go outside in the summertime, well, you know, and if we all know what the solar constant is, well, at least anybody in science does, it's 1360 to 70 watts per meter squared. It's a temperature, if you work that out, the temperature of 121 degrees Celsius, very, very hot. They get rid of that. They just totally throw that out. And they say, no, no, the temperature of the earth, the average temperature of the earth output, which is minus 18 degrees Celsius, they say that's what the solar input is. The sun is actually only heating the earth to minus 18 degrees Celsius. And it's like, well, what happened to the plus 121 degrees Celsius? So in any case, yes, they throw out the complete, they completely throw out the basic fundamentals of how, of understanding of how the climate works. Yes, the first point, the first step in understanding the climate should be the sun creates it, mostly around the equator equatorial regions where the sun is, you know, coming strongest. They throw that out. They don't start there. They actually get rid of that. That's where what the greenhouse effect is predicated on.
Well, what you're saying, and, what you're saying, Joe Postma, is heresy to these sold out corrupt academics. And the thing is that we won. I mean, I need to just clarify that although Michael Mann, the shining light of the UN IPCC, the golden boy in the third IPCC report, he led the way with his hockey stick graph. Well, you know, he invested huge amounts of money, not himself personally, but through, we believe, through the Suzuki Foundation. And it ran its course. 8 years, the claim went through the court, and sure enough, Timbal won. The case was dismissed because Michael Mann declined to admit his numbers into court to be examined. And what more proof do we need? It's gerrymandering of the numbers. It's fraud. And we argue, and we argue strongly, that Michael Mann is a criminal. He just hasn't been prosecuted because government and the authorities are too lax. Because these people, these corrupt scientists, are serving the agenda of corrupt governments. It's a tax-raising operation to make us all poor or to depopulate. Carry on, Joe.
In this world of litigation, I don't know why there isn't a process. Look at all the suing that goes on for such trivial things. Why isn't there an industry in suing scientists and suing this fake junk science? We could be making millions and billions of dollars in some, like, how do you get that started? Like, you know, we're not political people. We're not lawyers. Yeah. There's got to be a way to get that started, to start making money off these people.
There's a problem with that.
They're immune from prosecution. Every single one of these scientists are immune from prosecution under the UN Charter. Michael Mann is immune from prosecution. The only way to get back at Michael Mann, even though the British Columbia Supreme Court awarded costs to our colleague and co-author of the Sky Dragon book, Dr. Tim Ball, Michael Mann refused to pay. He brought the case and then he fled the country. He literally fled the US. And those who know the history know he disappeared off to Australia. This was in 2019. And we still haven't tracked him down. He's technically he's absconded from a court judgment. But you don't hear it in the press, do you? You don't hear it in the press because it's embarrassing to their narrative that their top climate scientist who rigged the numbers did a runner, court found against him, and he won't pay. And yet this fraud is still on the global circuit, on the media circuit, telling everybody that we must cut back our carbon emissions, that really it will be a smart thing to listen to Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and just accept the fact you will own nothing and be happy. And that's what we're dealing with, criminality pervading the entire realm of government and corporations. So, Charles Anderson, you have your say. Please step in.
Well, one of the problems with any sort of political effort to straighten this out is that most of the problem is caused by politics. You have to remember that the UN IPCC effort is controlled by governments, and they basically establish the policy, and then they say, okay, now scientists, you write the science in a way that backs up our policy. And if it doesn't back up their policy, they just have them rewrite it until it does. So it's a political process. It's not a scientific process. If it were a scientific process, the many wrong predictions that have been made would have been enough to sink the hypothesis of catastrophic man-made global warming many times over. You know, they've just made error after error after error in their predictions. And the scientific method says if you have a theory or a hypothesis that proves to be wrong empirically, when the evidence comes in that it's wrong, you have to abandon it. And they do not abandon it. They've been wrong over and over, and they can persist in it. And it's because it's not science. It has nothing to do with science. It has a great deal to do with what the governments want in terms of gaining more power. And because that power incentive is so strong, and they turn around and they corrupt the science. So they basically say, we're only going to fund you if you go out and do so-called climate research that says that man's use of fossil fuels is going to cause a great catastrophe in the near future. And if you don't say that, you don't get funding. And if you don't get funding, it's very hard to write the articles and do the research that's going to wind up getting published in the journals or can be published. And what's more, the journals don't want to publish it because, quite frankly, they have their own vested interest in this game. That, you know, if you have what kind of interest would there be in the climate if people weren't at least at the level that it is at? If people weren't saying that we're on the verge of a catastrophe, obviously there'd be a whole lot less interest in doing climate research. And so the journals that publish that sort of thing have a very vested interest in seeing to it that that remains having, you know, being presented as a future catastrophe.
Yeah, Charles Anderson, you're right on the money with that one. And it's all about follow the money. This is TNT Radio. We'll be right back after this short ad break.
Dolores Cahill on TNT Radio.
Give us an update from the Netherlands, and then if you wanted to touch as well on the worldwide news that we've seen about the farmers uprising in the Netherlands in the last few weeks.
Exactly. Yeah, we are now in the spotlight of the world, so to say. The farmer uprising is carrying on, and it's been carrying on now for 6 weeks, I believe, and they're not slowing down. It is coming head to head. We see a lot of extreme framing, a lot of undercover police trying to incite violence, trying to start fires on the highway and blame the farmers for it. And what is so magnificent about this uprising is that they have a huge public support. And they were talking about 70 to 80% of the whole Dutch population standing behind the farmers.
Weekends with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
A lot of people may not agree with us right now, but there may come a time when they actually have an issue that affects them, that they don't have the freedom to choose. And if we don't preserve it, we won't have it.
Get to see this for yourself.
We begin this new week with an extraordinary moment in our history. 18 days into this truck convoy, and the federal government invoked a security measure that goes beyond anything seen in this country in the last 50 years.
Banks will be told to freeze the accounts of anyone helping finance the protests. And the owners of vehicles jamming streets will be directly targeted.
Trucking for Freedom, Chapter 1, How We Got Here. Visit truckingforfreedom.com.
There's no dispute. The jabs are not safe or effective. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
All right, welcome back. Charles Anderson, you're an applied scientist. You're a man who makes his living working in a laboratory. You do a lot of work. You're an expert in spectroscopy. I believe you started off working for the United States Navy. You've had a 38-year career, I believe, and you know your stuff, don't you? You do know what it means in a laboratory setting to prove something to a fine level of detail, and you do a lot of work commercially. Just give listeners a bit of an insight into your commercial work so we know where you're coming from.
Well, primarily, I do spectroscopic analyses of materials using radiation, X-ray radiation, infrared radiation, electron beams and ultraviolet light and visible light. And we study materials properties using those means of radiation. And from that, we can address many, many problems that, say, manufacturing companies might have and with their processing of materials or just simply determining what properties they need for their application, helping them to specify what they need. We can do a great deal of work on problems that arise, such as so adhesive bond failures or issues relating to corrosion or degradation of polymers. A very wide range of problems can occur due to the types of environments or new applications that materials are put to use in. We have a great deal of success in solving these problems. So people keep coming back to have us solve more of their problems over the years, fortunately.
Yeah, it's a commercial success story, isn't it, really? If you're correct on the science, applied science is a wonderful career. My own son is an applied scientist. I've got family members who are engineers and applied scientists. It's a great career. Anything in the STEM field usually gets respect. And I take my hat off to you because it's a competitive business. And obviously, it's a cut and dried business because it either works or it doesn't. With your line of work, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, if you don't calibrate materials, if you don't do an assessment that's to the customer's liking, to the accepted contracts, then obviously you pay a penalty, and worst case scenario, people could die. This is something I've noted with a lot of applied scientists and engineers, that when I speak to those from your neck of the woods, it's always very much down to finally quantifying things very precisely. A lot of people would speaking on behalf of the average person, a lot of people don't have a taste for that. They don't have a background in that, but they do respect it. They do respect that when engineers and applied scientists, they design bridges, when they design cars or airplanes, they know those things will function to a very high tolerance. However, on the other side of the argument, we're getting the other type of scientists that we're opposed to, which are government scientists, which are theoretical scientists. They tend to work in academia and universities. And they rely on grants, don't they? The grants they're paid are usually to come up, as you said, to come up with a certain solution, predetermined. And this is what many of us call post-normal science. Post-normal science is where they like to cloud the issue and they can bring in the fudge factor. And they don't like it when we come in and tread on their toes, do they? And I'm betting that you probably never had an open debate in your career, certainly in the climate debate, with any academic who would challenge you on your arguments from the applied science point of view. Have you ever noticed them coming to debate you?
No, that's funny. What happens is that they ignore the arguments and after they call me a few names, they don't address the issues. I write many essays or many articles on these issues on my blog, Objectivist Individualist. And they choose to ignore them. There are a couple of websites that have, for instance, tried to evaluate various people who write on climate that are what they like to call deniers. Usually what they do is they say, well, we don't see him as a climate scientist. And actually, I don't either. I see myself as a physicist who addresses the basic issues of physics that they have to get right in order to get their climate ideas right. And because they don't get the basic physics right, then they don't get the climate predictions right. And that's what I try to emphasize. It's just the basic physics. Do they get it right or do they get it wrong? And they get it wrong, but they will not address those issues. They just ignore them. There are so many issues that are wrong that I haven't even started to touch on yet with you in the discussion here. One of the ones that's really egregious is that the radiation that is emitted from the Earth's surface that they claim is absorbed by the atmosphere They basically claim that the atmosphere can absorb far more radiation than a so-called black body could. And a black body is the best possible absorber in physics. And yet they claim that it can absorb much, much more than that. And that despite the fact that even if it could absorb as much as a black body effectively, it basically would not be able to reach that level even, because the reality is that when a greenhouse gas absorbs a photon, it actually collides with the other molecules around it in the air a billion times or more before it would re-emit any radiation. So the collision time is so great that the energy that it has absorbed from below a lower layer of the atmosphere, which is warmer, is distributed and shared with all the other molecules in the layer of air that this particular absorbing molecule was in. And then when it does re-emit radiation, it emits radiation at that lower temperature of that layer that it's equilibrated with. So it cannot possibly do better than a greenhouse gas, it cannot possibly do better than so-called black body absorber. And yet they claim it does, given the temperatures of the atmosphere. So it turns out that in order to actually absorb as effectively as they claim, you would have to go several times the radius of the entire solar system out into space to get cold enough to be able to absorb energy as effectively as they claim that the atmosphere does. And that's just totally unphysical. There's no way that that can happen. So it's another very basic way in which they've broken basic physics.
Well, the way I look at it, Charles, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you don't agree with me, is I look at it that there's different ways of looking at the problem in terms of, on the one hand, we have genuine incompetence. We do know that these academics are promoted well above their pay grade, really, in terms of competence. And the other thing is there are the hardcore we would call the criminally corrupt. And those are the ones usually the most strident in their pronouncements, and those who are, those who we would probably name, in the media. They're usually on TV, they're usually in the media, that usually get press releases. I'm thinking of people, like Michael Mann, who we had the major lawsuit defending against. Now, these are people who made millions of dollars. Michael Mann claims to be a Nobel Prize winner, which is again a fraud. The thing is, people buy into that, don't they? The public generally are looking for authority figures. They're looking for people who they are told are the ones to trust. And you might have noticed, like me, I mean, I found it very amusing during the pandemic, where we had very similar modus operandi. We get these same bogus experts, these figureheads coming out. And I'm thinking of the usual crowd. You've got, we had in the UK, Professor Neil Ferguson, who Imperial College, Cambridge, he predicted 1 million people would die in the UK from this dreaded virus. And, it's computer models, isn't it? Computer models that really, it's GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. But people buy into that, don't they? They think, well, the wonders of computers. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we've all absolved ourselves of responsibility. Nobody does calculations anymore. They either do it through their smartphone, they'll ask somebody else. We've lost the art of doing the number crunching ourselves, haven't we? Do you find that? Do you feel there's a general dumbing down and people are easily swayed by authority figures?
Well, it is true that people look for authority figures far too often to just tell them what to believe in. When I do write my own articles on these subjects, I really try to spell out in great detail all the aspects of the reasoning and the math and make it as simple as possible. And in fact, I try to avoid any complex math in any case. I tend to take an approach that says, let's look at what the upper or the lower bounds of this can be physically. I don't necessarily have to show that that a particular complicated effect is exactly this. I just need to show that we can bind it between these two within a range. And then I can show in many cases that the UN IPCC reports and other results that people are putting forth in the name of this AGW theory or lie outside of those bounds. And part of the advantage of just taking that approach is that instead of handing people a whole bunch of integral equations to evaluate and differential equations to solve and try to follow what I'm saying, I don't have to do that. And indeed, that's not my function. I'm not actually a climate scientist per se. I'm just trying to hold their feet to the fire and say, okay, you need to be within the realm of real honest physics here. And if you aren't, then clearly you're wrong. And we shouldn't be wasting our time and effort on you. And we certainly shouldn't be allowing you to destroy the standard of living of all mankind. So, well,
Charles, how do you think they get away with it then? Because, you know, the science, it's just so obvious. I mean, yeah. I mean, on one hand, we have to understand that lay people working part-time jobs, people working, you know, sales, things like that, they're not, you know, most people don't know what a differential equation is, never heard of it in their life, right? They know about adding and subtracting, right? Okay. So certainly, I mean, there's a whole media apparatus there that we're fighting against. But, you know, it's just, how do you think they're just getting away with it? Is it just, and why, how do you see that there's this connection between whoever's educated enough to commit this scientific fraud and then the connection to the media? I don't know. You want to help sort that out?
Well, I do think that almost any time that you get politics mixed up with science, you corrupt the science. You know, we've seen that many, many times. There was once upon a time a eugenics movement in the United States that was largely political and backed by a lot of scientists. There was the Lysenko nonsense in the Soviet Union that went on for a long time and caused, it was just total nonsense science, but it held sway within the Soviet Union because of the politics. And now we have the UN, which has gathered up a whole bunch of countries and basically said, we can arrange to have much more power for the international agreements and a more global unity for the purposes of apparently having a more socialistic world. You just gathered everybody together.
Yeah, you did make the point that it was about power, and certainly you can see that. But this is, they're not actually doing anything good. They're not actually doing any good positive forms of socialism with it, actually helping anybody. The power that they're amassing seems only to be to destroy. Don't you think? They're just hurting.
Well, I think I think they see destruction as the pathway to being able to set up a new world order and a new way of doing things. They've talked about such things as eliminating personal property entirely. Nobody will own anything of their own. And everybody will be confined to housing that gives them no more than 250 square feet per person. I mean, on the World Economic Forum and some of these global discussion groups, they're talking about some really outlandish things.
Yeah, they're doing it in the name of science. Well, they're using science to beat us with, and that's what angers me so much, because they're actually appealing to our rational sensibilities, saying that, you know, if you're logical, rational, and sensible, then you should support what the scientific evidence shows. And ironically, they don't have the evidence, do they? Like in the case of Michael Mann, he hid the evidence. We're up against secret science. I mean, anybody who knows and done any research on the global climate models, these computer models that they use, the UN relies on, they're hidden, aren't they? We don't even know the algorithms, we don't even know the kind of data parameters they use. All we know is that somewhere, somehow, there's some concept called the greenhouse gas theory that is running the show. And yet, they can't even agree on the theory. I mean, I've spoken to so many scientists, I'm sure you have too, who support the greenhouse gas theory, but they've all got their own pet theory, haven't they? They've got their own pet version. And some say the atmosphere heats from top to the bottom. Others say it heats from the ground up.
John, that's such a good point. That's such a good point. And that just reminds me of quantum mechanics. How we have, 27 different interpretations of quantum mechanics, and they all seem fine with that. And because that is the prevailing culture in physics now, I suppose, yeah, that is extended to this green aspect climate change, which actually has no real definition. If you look into the definitions, there's several which are mutually exclusive. But I suppose this is now the state of science where we just accept that this can be the state of things. That's a bit disturbing, isn't it? So we have this greenhouse gas theory, which has several mutually exclusive, contradictory, self-contradictory explanations. And and at the basis of it, like we've been saying, it is based on no valid physics that you can even possibly imagine. Yeah. Well, you know, flat earth theory. It's literally flat earth theory.
We'll come back to the contradictions in these so-called theories in a little while. We're just going to take another break. This is TNT Radio Live.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
We've made a very serious discovery. If you look at CFACT, I published an article on correlation there. I guess it's a blog nowadays. But the serious discovery is there is a direct correlation between the increase in the price of postage stamps and CO2. Obviously, the increase in postage stamps is causing increasing temperatures and increasing CO2. So the solution is get the price of postal stamps down. Here's another ditty. More people get sunburned and melanoma in the summer. More people also eat ice cream cones during the summer. What does this tell you? We've got to get rid of ice cream. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist and ice cream lover, Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, reminding you to enjoy your ice cream cone and the weather before someone takes both of them away from you.
Since the day I stopped drinking, my life has gotten better and better. I can't take any credit for it. It just seems that without alcohol, I think better. I'm more careful with money. I watch what I say. I don't get into trouble like I did when I was drinking. It's scary trying to walk through life alone. And today, I have that very distinct feeling that I don't ever have to be alone again.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, welcome back, Sky Dragon Slaying, and Dr. Charles Anderson is discussing with us the problem of the greenhouse gas theory. We wrote about it in our book in 2010, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory, and Dr. Anderson was a co-author with myself and Joe Olson and several others, and we all had different backgrounds. The idea was that we recognized the atmosphere was a very complex thing to study, that no one discipline would have all the answers. And so we took a very wide-ranging approach to the whole issue. And what we found is we could not find a settled version of the greenhouse gas theory. And in fact, we wrote an article in 2015. In fact, one of my colleagues, past president of the association, Principia Scientific, John Elliston. John Elliston wrote an article in 2015 for us. Is no greenhouse effect possible from what the IPCC define it? And John Elliston is a highly decorated engineer from Australia. He's in fact got the highest awards in Australia. He's very well known in his industry. And he argued that, in fact, on page 946 of the report, number 4, 2007, the IPCC actually have a contradiction. The way they define the greenhouse effect, they talk about radiant energy reaching the Earth from the sun as is the only source of heat to maintain all very global climate. And then they go on and change that. They change it later to say that the effect is coming from the atmosphere itself. And that they're actually arguing that the sun does not emit enough energy on its own to give us a temperature. And they say that temperature, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe Possum, Joe Olson, is minus 18 degrees. And, you know, that's shocking. Shockingly low number to say that the sun effectively only warms the Earth that much. And anybody, I mean, I'm talking to you from the UK. We're in the middle of another heat wave here. Temperatures today, 95 degrees. There's no cloud cover. Going out in the sun, it's blistering temperature. And when the clouds do arrive, sure enough, we see immediate cooling effect. Now, surely the sun is doing more. It's not the atmosphere warming. I mean, it's the sun. I mean, even a fool can see that. Where do they get these theories from? Can anybody give me some answer on this? I mean, Joe Posner?
I can address that.
Charles, go ahead, please.
Right. Well, part of the answer here is that actually the sun doesn't do all of the heating in reality. It's the Earth's gravity acting on our atmosphere creates part of the warming. So a part of what is normally attributed to the so-called greenhouse effect is really caused by the Earth's gravity acting on the atmosphere itself, that the higher basically the higher the kinetic energy of the molecules in the atmosphere, the higher their temperature. So the kinetic energy is higher for the molecules that are close to the Earth's surface. And as you go higher up into the atmosphere, the kinetic energy is lower and they have more potential energy. So they have there's a conservation of kinetic and potential energy within the Earth's gravitational field there. And so what you do is you come down through the atmosphere toward the Earth's surface is you're increasing the kinetic energy, but the kinetic energy is proportional to the temperature. So the gravity of on acting on our atmosphere itself contributes part of that so-called temperature difference that people call that 33 degree temperature difference that people say exists between basically the Earth's surface having no atmosphere and basically radiating all of the absorbed energy back out into space that comes from the sun. A good part of that is due to the gravitational field, and part of that is due to the fact that we do have gases that absorb the infrared radiation coming from the Earth's surface. But the key part of that, in terms of the absorption that does the warming, is the very first absorption that occurs. It's when you're sitting there, that molecule, say, a meter above the Earth's surface, so usually a water molecule, and it absorbs the radiation that came from the surface, and it prevented that radiation from going off into space because that water molecule was there. And then at that point, the critical thing is that it transfers that energy to all the other molecules around it that cannot absorb radiation, the nitrogen and the oxygen and even the argon atoms that constitute our atmosphere. And it's that combination. At that point, then it's convection that takes over as the primary energy transport for moving energy from the Earth's surface up into the upper atmosphere. So, and after that, the radiation that plays a role is in effect cooling instead of warming. And yet most people count all of these other interactions at higher elevations. Every time a CO2 molecule absorbs a photon that was emitted from another part of the atmosphere below it, they count that as warming. But in reality, what it's done is it's shifted the transport of energy from very slow convection that can take hours to rise from the Earth's surface up to the upper atmosphere into radiation, which moves at the speed of light. And so since it's moving the energy upward at the speed of light, essentially, and no matter how many times it goes up and down in their theories, it still would emit out of the atmosphere in much less than a second. The radiation absorption, other than that very first time that it was captured so that it could be converted into convection energy, as it were, rising up through the atmosphere. All that other radiation absorption is not doing much, really. So the actual effect of the CO2 is very, very little, really, beyond that first absorption. Now, at different parts of the frequency range, that first absorption can occur at different heights above the surface, depending on the frequency we're talking about, whether it's for the water vapor or for the CO2 molecule. But usually it's going to be in the very bottom of the troposphere, the lowest part of the atmosphere. And as long as that's the case, then it's able to convert that into convection that moves slowly.
Yeah, and what the atmosphere tends to do is it redistributes the warm air. And we know that the Coriolis effect is a part of this as well. We know that through cyclonic and anticyclonic movements of air masses, that like right now in the UK, we're having a heat wave, but somewhere else is having cooler temperatures. basically the temperature, the energy just being moved around the system. And quite often the record breaking we get, we hear so much about in the media. Well, the record breaking works both ways, doesn't it? Because if somewhere is having a very hot temperature, somewhere else is having a cooler temperature, because we know for a fact the energy coming into the atmosphere is going out as well. It's, there's no difference, is there? The calculations, NASA confirms the energy coming in measures up to the energy leaving the Earth. So we're not seeing a buildup of energy, are we, over the long term?
Well, yeah, basically, there's been a slow warming since the end of the Little Ice Age. And imposed on that slow warming has been oscillation. There have been oscillations up and down where there's a little bit of a dip relative to that that linear rise in temperature, or there's a little bit of a you know, sort of a wave that exceeds it for a few years. And these changes are like on the order of 30 years commonly, or maybe less than that, 20 years. But they're just oscillating around a slow rise in temperature, which we would expect after the Little Ice Age had cooled down the oceans. And now, even if you have a constant input of sunlight at this point, it's basically going to be pouring energy into the oceans still to warm them up. And it's been doing that since the end of the Little Ice Age. So that's basically what's going on, I think, is that as the oceans have warmed up, then the rest of the climate around the world has been able to warm up slowly. And it's not necessarily translated to, you know, a recent increase in either energy from the sun or CO2 molecules in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and a lot of people who know, have done any research in climatology, will tell you that what climatologists look at is the movements between Hadley cells. Hadley cells are from George Hadley in 1735. He noticed that each hemisphere, westward wind and equatorial flow of wind, the energy flows from the equator to the poles. We're dealing with a wonderful air conditioning system, aren't we? I think the better way to characterize the Earth is look at the water cycle. The water cycle is doing a fantastic job in moderating Earth's temperatures, because our nearest neighbor, the moon, it seems it has far more extreme temperatures from hot to cold than the Earth, and we would not survive on the moon if we had to endure those temperatures. And even even in the tropics, even though it's hot, you've got variability on a scale that it's livable, isn't it? And wherever you go on the planet, we seem to be doing okay, and we seem to cope, and we've mainly been coping through ice ages. We are living now through an interglacial. We've only got some people say we're 12,000 years into this interglacial, and we could be leaving at any time soon, maybe another 5,000 years, who knows. It's really the danger of cold we should be fearing, not heat. And anybody with a brain cell will tell you that, just look around. If you know anything about animal husbandry, if you know about crops and things, animals thrive, crops thrive in warmer climates. You don't see much farming in the polar regions, do you? It's just common sense. The most abundant, rich sources of life are in the very tropical zones. Tropical zones, people know this. I mean, it's the abundance of life. Are people that stupid to miss this? I'm questioning my own sanity sometimes.
Well, I do think that a slight warming of the Earth would actually lead to more benefits for more people than cause harm. And of course, the rising CO2 levels are also providing much better plant food, because they rely on taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and the photosynthesis process to grow. And so we are, in fact, seeing, as the CO2 is increased in the atmosphere a bit, we're seeing increased green spreading across the Earth, and plants are doing better as a result. In fact, I was looking at something here recently where they were showing that over the last several hundred million years, that the CO2 level had been dropping and dropping and dropping, And we were at a point where if it continued on the pace it was going, it would get too low for plant life to live in another 5 million years. Now, 5 million years seems like a long time to us, but nonetheless, the reality was that it was getting close, slowly, but getting close to the threshold of the minimum amount of CO2 that plants needed back in the 1800s there, in the late 1800s. So the increase in CO2 since then has been very beneficial to plants, and it would continue being beneficial if it did double, actually. And a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere would not do much to change the temperature. And insofar as it did, it would be beneficial to increase the temperature by that amount.
Charles Anderson, it's really a pleasure talking to you. We're just coming to the end of the first hour. We'll be joining you again in the second hour. This is John O'Sullivan, Sky Dragon Slaying. We'll be right back after the news.